Hello, I'm John Waters, and I'm supposed to announce there is no smoking in this theater, which I think is one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard of in my life. How can anyone sit through a length of a film, especially a European film, and not have a cigarette? But don't you wish you had one right now? And I'm telling you, smoke anyway. It gives ushers jobs. And if people didn't smoke, there would be no employment for the youth of today. So once again, no smoking in this theater.
We have fun.
Nice to meet you.
I could see Aaron's soul start to leave his body when Cody said that he was going to have that cocktail without ice in it.
I was going to heat it up. I was going to boil it.
He's going to boil it.
Not actually alcoholic when he's done with it.
Get a nice simmer going on the Boulevardier mix.
That's right. Delicious. Get a nice glaze. You could put it on a chicken or a
just
ham.
Temperature Boulevardier.
Yeah.
God, now we're talking. Here on Try Love, there's no segue. Thank you so much for listening to it. It's a roundtable podcast, literally roundtable, even though this desk here is rectangular.
Many more episodes now that we've been figuratively
roundtable
than literally.
It has been. Someday. Surely we shall overcome. But we have we discuss movies that we've seen or people that we've met. We discuss them at the Trilon or through it. Sometimes it's not exactly there. You can find us on Twitter at Trilove Podcast. That's at and then Trilove Podcast, all in word. You can find me on Twitter. Oh, sorry. You can find the Trilon, more important, at Trilon Cinema and at Trilon.org. You can get tickets to movies like this one and others that play there regularly on and off schedule stuff. Get into the Trilon Club for cool secret screenings like the one that Cody was able to attend this past weekend. Tell us a little bit about that really quick, Cody.
If I could describe it in one word, it would be orgasmic. Get it? Because I watched the movie Orgy. It was awesome. It's the easiest, 5 hours that I've ever sat down and watched something nearly straight through. I got up and went to the bathroom once. Shout out to the third of a theater full of people who mostly stayed through the whole thing as well. I think John said that only three people got up and left and didn't end up coming back at some point. And he, bless him, he did his best to get us to, he's like, hey, go out, see the sun for a little while and then come on back. It's how it was designed. No, motherfucker, we're going to sit here and watch the whole thing. Going to hunker down, get my ass prints firmly in this seat because I'm not going anywhere. It was truly awesome.
Fantastic time Cody had, the orgasmic, Cody's cummies, if you will. But check it all out at Trilon.org, a member of the Trilon Club, buy a piece of merch, buy tickets, do some cool stuff with the Trilon because they're a cool place. But me, I'm just Jason Daphnis. I help make the show that you're listening to, and I'm on Twitter at Nintendoofus.
I like sports, so my friends all call me Jocko, and you can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narvison.
I'm Harry Mackin. You can find me on Twitter at PunishTake, but if I were you, baby, I wouldn't go sticking out my jugular vein.
And my name is Aaron Grossman, but for my contributions to this film's soundtrack, I was referred to just as Little Aaron Grossman. You can find me on Twitter at RBPlee.
Very good. There's actually very little that I can say about this movie without revealing the title of it. I will say that it played as part of a series of two films by this director, sort of lost, unseen, underseen films of the mid-century. You can check out information on that at the Trilon's website. We'll also probably talk about some of these movies in the Barrys. Check those out in December. I'm going to start seeding, sort of pre-marketing the Barrys early in the year now. It's only March, but we've got a lot of hype to build. We have many, many, many awards to give out.
I'm going to start doing Year of Ping Pong, I guess. I'm going to start doing guerrilla marketing for that.
It has to be Year of the thing. You know what I mean? So Year of the Pings Ping Pong, I'll take.
Year of the Ponged Pings.
No, Year of the Ping Pong. You're
both ruining this for me.
Listen, we did it. Aaron, we did it.
It can't be what either of you said. It's the thing that I said, and going to sink the whole category if... No.
There is something, talking about things that you said, Aaron, can you tell us what this movie is and what it's about?
Yes, indeed, folks. We are talking about Nothing But a Man, 1964 film directed by Michael Romer. The film stars Ivan Dixon as Duff Anderson, a black railroad worker who by chance meets pastor's daughter, Josie Dawson, played by jazz singer Abby Lincoln. The two fall in love despite a disagreement from her father, played by Stanley Green. And eventually the two get married, but Duff finds it hard to make ends meet in the small southern racist town. Yaphakoto in this film as Jocko, Julius Harris as Will Anderson, Duff's father, and Gloria Foster, the great Gloria Foster, as Will, Duff's father's new girlfriend, Lee. The film was written by Romer, as well as his writing partner and frequent, not too frequent because he wasn't very prolific, but frequent collaborator, Robert M. Young. Romer, who was Jewish and who had fled Nazi Germany in the late 1930s, drew upon his experiences of persecution as a young boy when writing the film. Romer and Young spent a good amount of time in the American South, kind of bouncing around from town to town, I guess, kind of becoming familiar with its culture and the lives of specifically the Black people in that region. The film was a critical success on release, won an award at the Venice Film Festival, was well critically received at other film festivals, but it kind of failed to make too big of a splash, largely due to kind of a lack of funding for like larger promotion,
surprise,
but also larger distribution. Yes, this film came out again, 64, so like Million Man March, you know, like a civil rights bill, like this was like right in the heat of it, right? The film was then kind of shelved until about 30 years later when a restored print was re-released in 1993, when it then kind of became to be more appreciated. This film is also known for its Motown soundtrack, which I'm sure we'll talk about. A lot of very famous names on that thing, and the story of that is kind of interesting as well. Basically, Romer kind of lucked into being able to buy the rights to a bunch of Motown songs before Motown was like really, really a thing.
Yeah, it's called like so in the credits, it's like the Motortown. It's some like remedial, yes, name for it, right? It's not just Motown Recording Studios or something like that before it had the name.
I mean, I joked about it at the beginning, but like Stevie Wonder is on this as little Stevie Wonder.
And also, know, like, just
Stevie Wonder started playing music when he was like, well, started recording and making hits when he was like
on the way
13,
out the womb,
you know?
Right.
Yeah, he started playing at -6. But yes.
Imagine getting everything as right as this movie gets, right down to the fact that you like basically have the future of music like 2 years before that music hits the mainstream, and this movie still doesn't do, like, this guy's got to be so pissed. He's like, what more do I have to do? I basically depicted a movie 50 years ahead of its time in every way, and it still just didn't make a splash because I guess people weren't ready for it. Your kids are going to love it, that sort of thing.
Speaking of 50 years ahead of its time, you referred to her as the great Gloria Foster. Can you fill me in on why she's great? The actress who played
fucking Lee? Loser nerds like us will know her as the Oracle from The Matrix. She also was an extremely famous, like, she did like a bunch of movies. I think she was kind of most prolific as like a theater star. She did like a bunch of, you know, I was looking this up earlier. She was a Chicago person, born and raised in Chicago. So thumbs up, shout out to Chicago. But yeah, she was Oracle. She was a big theater performer. She was in a lot of movies, TV shows, things of that nature. But again, us losers, the Oracle.
She was in Raisin in the Sun, very famously, yes, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Fantastic. Continue. Harry, yeah, I mean, it's ahead of its time in a lot of ways. Harry, do you care to expound upon that a little bit now that we know what it's about?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to just be too effervescent about it or too sort of exulting, but I was unbelievably blown away by this movie. I think just in terms of like its commentary on the Black experience, its commentary on the class experience and on the intersections between class and race and gender. I think that this is in some ways a better race movie than I've ever seen, a better class movie than I've ever seen, and a better gender movie that I've ever seen all at once, precisely because it is so interested in examining the intersection of those things and the effect that they had on the Black American experience, what it means to be a Black man in the sense of all that is, right? A poor Black man and need to sort of have this like need to provide for yourself and your family and this need to measure up to sort of like heteronormative standards of manhood and all that means, even though those standards are not prescribed for the Black experience and are much more difficult to attain for being a Black person, and the frustration that follows when you know that those things are true, but nonetheless feel this unbelievable pressure, and how this pressure can warp and distort a person and make them sort of take out their grievances on the people they love or the people around them. I found this like unbelievably sympathetic, nuanced portrait of the Black experience as far as I like understand it, right? Like, obviously we're four white guys talking about it. Got to get that out of the way right away, right? But and just sort of like grounded in some of the best performances I've ever seen. I love Gloria Foster. I think she's amazing in this movie. She has basically two big scenes. I was most blown away by Abby Lincoln, actually. I think that like this is maybe one of my favorite female performances of all time. She just like, she has this like sympathy for everyone that is like so earned and so grounded and melancholic, and you can just read it in her face. Like, she understands the people around her, and she understands why they are the way they are, and she forgives them for that, but she also knows that she is not sort of she is not above them in the sense that they can still really ruin things for her, and have, and that like live, that resentment lives alongside this like this really open empathy that she has for them. And the way that this movie depicts Black womanhood is every bit as interesting as the way it depicts Black masculinity. Mm-hmm. And there's just like almost too much to talk about here, but I don't know, just to say like, I think that by the time this episode comes out, this might already be out of the trilon, but you should absolutely see it. I think that like I'm hard pressed to think of a movie that I was more like, that I knew less about and that I was more glad I had seen than this one going into the trilon. And that's kind of a big deal at this point, because we've done a lot of trilon dry runs that I've really been moved by. But maybe you guys feel similarly or different. Aaron, what do you feel about this movie?
It's worth talking about the thing that I think everybody talks about this movie about, right? Which is like kind of big thing out of the way. This movie is like directed by a white guy, right? And not just like a white American, but like a white European who like made his way on over to America eventually. And I think that like, you know, it's not like my original thought. A lot of people have written about this. I think this might even be something pointed out in like their Criterion blurb for this, right? But like, I think there is something weirdly unique that works about somebody from outside of America being the one to kind of, you know, come here and like make this film, right?
It reminded me of Paris, Texas in that way. You know what I mean? Like the Wim Wenders movie.
Right. Just someone who is like so detached from. So obviously it's like, it's not as good as like, you know, a Black person making this film, right? Like that would probably be a little more like closer and like, you know, close to home and accurate in that manner. But I do think that there is something to be said for like, you know, if a white guy is going to make this film, I think like a white guy who is not kind of blinded maybe by the nature of race in America, although certainly coming from a place where race is like this large topic, right? But like coming over here and like doing so many specific things like kind of weirdly wrong, but like nailing the big swings in a way that it doesn't really matter, right? Like there's maybe, I don't know, 1.5 Southern accents in this movie set in the South, and not just like kind of the South, but like set in the South, like near Birmingham, right? This movie does not really feel Southern, except for at times, maybe aesthetically, right? But I think that like, you know, Romer really does get it. He gets, you know, the nature of the Black experience in the South at this time, the nature of a country, you know, going through this big civil rights movement in this transitionary state that maybe is not as transitionary as a lot of people would like, right? Still clinging to a lot of its kind of history and past however ugly that may be. And I also think that like he really gets the nature of like class in these sort of environments and how it's like used as this kind of cudgel to like, you know, wield over people who you have more power than, right? Or at least the white people do to the black people in this movie. I think that like a lot of that is quite interesting and nuanced. I think a lot of it is, it's clearly something that, that he, you know, he talked about when he came over, you know, when he fled Germany, that is, in the
right,
late
1930s. That's also a very important thing to say about him, right? Is that he's Jewish,
yeah.
Which is, you know,
yes,
very material to his politics.
He had his entire family's like possessions and whatnot, you know, basically taken from them in the 1930s. He witnessed how hard it is to not just like live yourself, but also provide for others to kind of ensure that your family has what they need. Right. I mean, that is a core theme of this film. And that is something that is, you know, not to pretend like all systems of oppression are universal in that way, but that aspect of it is something that is universal and feels a lot more true than a lot of other movies that, that kind of deal with class by white dudes from this time period, or race by white dudes from this time mm-hmm. period. So I, there's a lot of it that's like very nuanced and like, again, it, it like misses some of the specifics, but like in a way that I don't care, right? Not to say that nobody necessarily would, maybe someone from, you know, maybe someone from the South would be like, hey, what are you doing? But I think that like, it really knocks it out of the park on like kind of this larger level that works for me.
Yeah, it does. It's astounding that, and knowing nothing about Romer before, at least starting to watch this movie, I had to watch it in two chunks, but, it is astounding how, like you said, he closely, he kind of seems to get it. And again, backing off here and recognizing we're four white guys and three in Minneapolis who are just seeing this movie for the first time. But, like, the fact that he can even approximate, getting it and like the sort of like behaviors and attitudes and nature of, communities of the South and specifically black communities of the South in like literally maybe 3 months after, the Civil Rights Act passed, just like the contemporaneous and like forward looking nature of some of that story. And the fact that that sort of like, I'm not sure how hard he was trying versus how much of it just came as part of like a natural extension of his filming style, but like that realness is carried through the filming style, which I'm sure we can talk about a little bit. The performances feel very, the scripting. And again, like the story in the world that it builds where it's like, it is not, as maybe you would assume over the first 25, 30 minutes of the movie. It's not just a black man has trouble at the hands of white man, of, you know, white male oppressors in the deep South where he lives. It is actually far more, like you said, nuanced than that. There are, it's split more along class and gender lines than just strictly race, like Harry was saying earlier. And it's just like that commitment to the, like exploring the nuanced angles of what it was really like. Technically, what it was really like to exist as a black man in the, you know, in like an era of civil rights movement, and sort of like the value, the action that that drove, and sort of like the maybe iniquities of the movement as a whole, in almost in like a retrospect look before it was even like quote unquote over. Just fantastic. And I think you could point at this movie from any angle, from like filming to performance, to writing, and say like, oh yeah, that's a pretty good penetration point to getting at that, like essential realness that it is shooting for. And like the authenticity with which it seems to approach any of those things carries through almost every other aspect of the movie. So I'll abdicate to Cody, for wherever he wants to go and penetrate the conversation of this movie.
Nice. You said the word penetrate a lot, which is very cool and good of you, Jason. Appreciate that. I would like to, I want to touch back on pretty much, I don't want to say everything y'all have been, kicking around. A lot of good points. It's got my neurons firing again, after watching this movie last night, which was an awesome experience. Didn't see it at the Trilon, did what I could at home. It is streaming in from what I can tell it is. It seems to be the nicer looking, you know, like the restored version. So if you can't make it to the Trilon, at least you have that, but you should go to the Trilon really, if at all possible. I gravitated toward the two performances that Harry shouted out up top. Those of, Gloria Foster and Abby Lincoln. Gloria Foster as Lee, like the presence that she commands, that sort of stone wall that we start to slowly see chip away, because like she's naturally on guard and wary of probably everybody, but specifically men, and specifically men who are like associates of Duff's father, Will Anderson. And the fact that he's like, oh, this is my son, that just like does nothing to phase her. And then you, as Duff starts to, you know, speak with Lee more, like Lee becomes more of a confidant during their, as it was said, like really just two scenes together, than Duff has with his own father. And that is something of a soft backbone for the rest of the film, which again, Lee is sort of like a tentpole for that, was hugely valuable. And Abby Lincoln, her choices, like without reading it, you know, as much as we're able into like how much of this was her, how much of this was, Romer, but like the choices she made as far as, I think it was Harry, you said, you, something to the effect of her, like finding sympathy for and in everybody. She is often, holding back a smile, or there's like a soft smile on her lips during like the early scenes as she's getting to know Duff, and they're sort of at the push and pull.
Most charming shit I've ever seen in my life. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, and then as that sort of evolves into her, like her, sounds weird to say, but like her physicality and sort of like the middle act in like softening him, reining him in, that sort of like playful kind of roughhousing, and just like she always kind of like knowing what to say, how to say it, when to say it, and like always like de-escalating, but also like keeping a very level head, and not like saying that like you shouldn't be worried about these things. Like she'll say something to the effect of, you know, like, oh, you'll get a job. But that's because she like has faith in him as a person, not necessarily like him as a black man or them in this, like that balance, I think was, it was super well struck, and it got me thinking about, Abby Lincoln is sort of the poster child for this in this movie, but the way, like, I didn't know anything about Romer coming into this. So I started at like square one of just like, what are the things that I want to be like, what am I going to latch onto, and then learn from there. And the sort of basic, you know, we're cutting in a lot, basic, like shot, reverse shot, a lot of close-ups. What I noticed early on was like, not a lot of I don't want to say no eye contact was being made, but it was more often than not, like it was just like passing conversations, the railway gang, you know, Yaphet Kotto, these people who are working together, they're, you know, making casual conversation. They're sometimes making eye contact, sometimes not. Abby Lincoln is choosing appropriate moments to lock eyes, with Ivan Dixon. And it's almost, I don't want to say it's like anti-Ozu, but like how, like a lot of Ozu back and forth conversations, everybody's locking eyes all the time. Mm-hmm. And you're just like waiting for eye contact to hit here.
Right? Especially yeah. In that first scene, like he is pretty clearly trying not to make eye contact with her. And there are moments when she tries to bring it out of him, which characterizes their relationship really well.
Yeah. Yep. And bringing this, attempting to bring this through into the most recent points that were talked about, that technique is, I felt somewhat weaponized when we get into the scenes with like confrontations with these hordes of abrasive white dudes, where they're locking eyes all the time. It's a different sort of energy where like they are not shying away from, there's no like cat and mouse, like trying to win over the other person. Like they are locking eyes all the time. It's eerie. It's off-putting, and it helps to not like, it's eerie, but not so much that it's like over sensationalizing or over dramatizing these scenarios, these sorts of, like racially driven sequences that are, melded with, again, with this undercurrent of like Duff not wanting to, or like feeling weird about, you know, not wanting to become his father, and the sort of like weird predetermined path that he sets down, where like he tries to avoid it, and ultimately he's like, you kind of see it along the way, the writing's on the wall. I don't know. There's a lot of good stuff in the pot that is, it's swirling around. And I think that the fact that there's, I don't know, whichever way we want to go about, you know, talking about either of those or none of them, but I like that they are two poles that are not raised like in opposition, but there's enough for both to be kicking around, where we're not focusing on one. And I don't know how conscious that was of Romer, you know, an outsider coming into this, but the fact that there were a couple, you know, lightning rods that he could have directed his focus, like made both of them, I don't know, sit maybe a little better than they could have otherwise. That's me shooting from the hip, Harry. I have no idea if that bears any weight to how that hit you. But I just couldn't help but notice both of those threads working in tandem with one another.
What were the two threads that you meant?
So the scenes where the focus is Duff, like in these, like where it's at the forefront of his mind is just getting through the workday and not like not wanting to sacrifice him as like a proud black man and not having to like put on an act as his father-in-law, sort of like trying to get him to do, right? Like put on an act, be this other type of person, this subservient individual to just get through the day. That sort of mental exercise. And then a lot, and I guess this is maybe less actively done with him, but the along the way of him visiting his son and then subsequently going to visit his father. And then this sort of like him choosing, I characterize this one poorly, but him and Josie, like trying to make a home, trying to think about like the best way forward in like a domestic setting and how that like idyllic sort of like patch of paradise becomes nightmarish. Just like, I don't know. That's just me like establishing my framing of the movie. I don't know if like, one of those like stands out more than the other, but like they both are sort of like on an even level where I got a lot out of this movie because it entertained both of them so well.
Yeah. No, I really like that. Thanks for re-explaining that to me. The whole time you guys have been talking, I've been thinking about like why this movie quote unquote gets it to the extent that like we can talk about that or speak to that. Right. And like, Aaron, you said something that really stuck with me that I think helps explain and reconcile the two sort of lightning rods that you were talking about, Cody, which is that, I really love that you mentioned that Romer knew what it was like to struggle to provide for your family and how when you are struggling to provide, that takes precedence over everything else and really shapes your worldview and your ability to understand yourself. And I think that like the reason this movie works so well for me and is so ahead of its time in some ways is because it's so grounded in a materialist analysis of race and class. And even I would go so far as to say it's like it's about how materialism for the marginalized is like the only pathway toward achieving any sort of identity and self-determination that they want. And that's so precarious, right? Like Duff is so precarious in this movie, right? Like he has all of these ideas about himself, but he is so painfully aware that they are ideas that only exist in his head, right? Or ideas that are true, but that nobody else will ever see, right? Like he knows he's intelligent. He knows he's proud. He knows he's like better than the jobs that he's had and or like better than how he's been treated by white people. But because he doesn't have the material, like wealth to back that up, he can't make use of that. And so like we're stuck in this world where all of these characters, these black characters, are so intimately aware of the disconnect between who they are and who the world is allowing them to be. And that creates this sort of like overriding, like pessimistic realism that it reminded me a lot of like a Charles Burnett movie in that like all of these characters are so brutally aware of the nature of the world in which they're living and navigating. And that so totally defines everything about who they are, every conversation they have, every way they look at each other. Like it's all infused with this terrible precarity, right? And it's like it's not only a racial precarity, although the racial precarity is there, right? Like on their very first date, Duff and Josie are accosted by white guys, right? But it's also this idea that like, hey, like, you know, there's this incredible metaphor at the center of this movie that is the cotton field, right? Which is like everybody is saying like to Duff, if you can't get a job anywhere else, you can go back and pick cotton. And Duff literally says like, they've been doing that in my family for too long, right? It's like it's a pretty literal metaphor for like the return to slavery, The movie is basically all about him trying to avoid that, right? And what it means that he's trying to avoid that and what that's doing to the people around him. And I think that like that precarity is so fascinating because it defines all of these characters so well and in such a nuanced and sad way. And it really brings out the both of the nuance in both of the sort of lightning rods that you're talking about, right? Because we feel it, right? Like, we feel that the same struggles that Duff are going through are the struggles that have warped his father into the person he is. Duff can see himself in his father. At the end, he says, "Hell, I'm just like him," right? And so the movie, we talk a lot about training on the podcast, right? But like, the movie really trains you to understand just what it feels like to exist as a person who wants to be a man, who wants to be a father, who wants to be a husband, and who wants to be somebody, basically, in a world where that is all so contingent on these material realities that are being withheld from you, and how desperate that makes you, not only to provide for your family, but just to have to sort of be able to grasp at some identity and self-determination for yourself that everyone needs, right? Like, you need to feel like you're a man, right? And that's, this movie is largely about Duff's struggle. And though the movie is critical of that struggle, I think it also makes a really good case for the necessity of those feelings. Does that work with what you were thinking of saying next, Aaron? Sorry, bad transition.
No problem. I kind of read this film as primarily like being about the difficulty of existing as an imperfect person in a world or society that requires you to not just be perfect, but requires like more than perfection, right? It requires like an impossible amount from you, right? It requires you to not only and like
a,
never
a contradictory
up,
amount,
to,
right?
But to fit into a mold that is like counter to your humanity, right?
And that is constantly contradictory, right? Like, you have to be manly in the right ways at the right times and deferential at the right times in the right ways. And yes.
And I think that there is something to, making the character, making Duff this person who had kind of avoided a lot of that due to the kind of previous nature of his life, right? Like, he starts out the movie working on the railroads, right? And that kind of more, not like nomadic, but like that more kind of, I don't know, transient, let's say, lifestyle, kind of, you know, doesn't make him like avoid most of the stuff that he encounters later in the film, but at least like kind of blunts a little bit of it. And like, once he like finally settles down and like wants to marry a woman and wants to like own a piece of property and have like a job that doesn't require him to kind of travel around, that is when like the real kind of, you know, ills of the world start to weigh on him more
and
more.
And he's so dramatically aware of that, right? Like, I think, I don't remember if they ever use this phrase exactly, but like, I think at one point they literally refer to it as like, well, at least before he was a moving target, right? And like,
it is the nature of settling down into like a town, like specifically a small town, and not to like paint like Southern America's like,
well,
the
it's
only
literally
racist place
Birmingham,
in the country
Alabama.
At this point. Yes, but like, you know, there are places like that, places like that in the north, right?
Like, and they talk about that a lot in the movie, right? Like, they refer to many times, he's like, why don't you just go north? And he's like, oh, I've been up north and it's just as bad.
Same shit, right? And I think that there is something about something very nuanced about the nature of, you know, those issues in society becoming more pronounced with the kind of desire to settle down, that you know, it's quite nuanced. I think it's quite subtle, and I think that like that's where a lot of the depth in the film comes in. It's like, once he has to exist in this community of people who like are just diametrically opposed to who he is as a person, right? That is where like the conflict starts to arise. Well, and I think that point is like very interesting, I think,
right? Because you also like, you think about how that it's because that's what white people, that's what power's actually afraid of, right? Is settling, is beginning to build wealth and homestead.
Is like, they're okay with his job.
Yeah, yes. They're okay with a black man building their railroads, right? Like, I love the metaphor of railroads is like literally like immigrant transient labor. That's the sort of thing that people who don't have stakes in a community do. And they're comfortable with him as long as he's outside, but it's when he tries to enter and build the continuity for himself that they really can't make that. They can't allow that, right? And they do everything they can to take it apart.
So, Aaron, are you saying that, like, the character is set up as somebody who doesn't set high expectations for himself as, like, in relation to the capitalist class-based society that surrounds him. Is that what you mean to say? Like, is that the way that it's setting the scene with that character, do you think?
I think that it's maybe not necessarily like the level of standards. Like me personally, I don't assign any sort of moral weight to that sort of stuff.
Right.
But I do think the film is
it's not necessarily that like, oh, you know, working on a section gang and, you know, not settling down is bad, but in the society that he lives in the growing, like increasingly capitalist society now, like supposedly with the Civil Rights Act, black people are allowed to be like in more systematized ways, allowed to be part of this version of society. And he has maybe consciously or unconsciously chosen a path of life that does not jive with that until he meets Josie, of course, and then the story starts to change. But is that what you mean? Like his pre-state?
I would say that the desire to kind of settle down kind of requires you to kind of exercise your rights as a human in like a weird way, in a way that is often in direct opposition to people who may have up until that point maybe only known you on like a very short term, like mostly transactional basis, right? It's like if you're just like coming through town one day and you're helping to build the railroad, or you're, you know, if you're just kind of like, you know, serving them gas or something, yes, there are levers of power that they can kind of use to kind of exert their position over you. But I think that like the minute that you become something of like a figure that they have to deal with on like a larger level, I think that like that is when they start kind of weaponizing that power against you like repeatedly, right? Which
That's
is why like
descend yeah
gets in bad with like one job, and then he goes to like the opposing spot in town, and like the guy's like, oh yeah, we know your name around here, right?
Yeah,
like, well, word is traveled.
I think that lends a lot more, and Harry, I'm sure this plays right into where you were going hopefully, but like it's why it makes it so, you can see why it was so inevitable that he was going to leave a union job somewhere that like was going to support that way. Like his best, most rewarded, most freed self was part of this chain gang. Well, I mean, it's functionally, we'll say like metaphorically chain gang, but literally referred to as a section gang on the railroad. And when he moves into sort of that like settling down, accruing wealth, you know, building a family type mode, then he is forced to take a position that is, you know, that stratifies directly along the color of their skin, along the lines of established on the color of their skin, where like he was a union man with the railroad, he is not along at the sawmill or wherever else he works, and it's because that way of life afforded him that like personal dignity and respect, where it's not like part of the system that exists where he was looking to settle down, right?
Yeah, well, and I think we've characterized that really well. That's what I love so much about the first act, and what I talk about with the like the prevailing terrible awareness of precarity, right? Is that like there is like this almost if Beale Street Could Talk-esque like tragedy to the courtship of the first act here, right? Because like this whole time that she, Josie, is pursuing Duff, they are so aware of the full scope of the political and class implications of what they're doing with one another, right? That is like at the center of their courtship, right? Like, and all of Duff's friends know it too. They keep saying to him, like, what are you doing? You're throwing away the best thing you're ever going to get, right? Like that, this very gendered idea of like, well, at least like, as a man, as somebody who can work, I can eke out this little bit of freedom as long as I'm willing to make these other sacrifices, right? As long as I'm willing to give up my right to have a home, my right to have a family. But he can't do it, right? And so there's this fantastic idea throughout this movie that like they know that what they're choosing to do by choosing to want things that any person should want, would want, they are making this choice that's going to make life so difficult for them. And it creates this like this really nuanced, like Aaron said, and poignant backdrop to this romance, right? It's like it's a love story, but it's a love story about what it means to be in love when you are like black and poor in Birmingham, Alabama. And like those implications are so definitive of the relationship that they like, they work their way into every facet of the way that these two people communicate with each other and coordinate with each other and build a life together. And even that is something that is so terrible for both of them, right? To the point where, like, in the second act, when things sort of fall apart, so to speak, like, Duff has all of this resentment for Josie, and none of it has anything to do with who she is. It has to do with what she represents for him, right? The fact that she came from more money than he came from, the fact that she went to college, the fact that she has this job that brings in a steady source of income that he can't have, the fact that she wants these things from him, that he projects these desires onto her and treats them as pressures, right? And it's like, you can see how in this world where to settle down is to have to fight all of these things and is to have to confront these parts of yourself and live in this constant fear that you're not going to measure up, it perfectly prepares you to understand the psychology of both the characters in the second act, right? And I think it does that through the sort of like stakes of the courtship as that's set up in the first act in a way that I thought was really fascinating.
I'm glad you brought up like the idea of the precariousness of this being a pervading force throughout, like, of his station in life, of what he comes to want at this point in life. Also,
yeah, it's crushing, right? Like, just throughout the movie, it's everywhere.
It really is. And it, I think, not to bring it back solely to the performances here, but I think the performances are really a highlight in that, like, even there, I think there's something to be said for Ivan Dixon's performance as Duff, where there's this like sort of reservation about him, this sort of calm and cool that exists throughout like most of the character. There are only a couple of times that you start to see that facade start to slip, but it seems to be like very well earned, well learned. He is revealing a very little, even in his scenes with Josie, like Cody was saying, like there's rarely direct eye contact. It's almost like a threatening act to be shown on screen between two characters at times. There's a certain like playfulness and flirtingness throughout the course of their relationship until in the third act, when things start to like get really dire, you see us more direct, more honest, less reserved, less precarious, more like, I guess, chips all on the table type of everybody's just been compressed to an absolute pulp by the conditions that surround them, that like those performances change over time. You were talking about Abby Lincoln as Josie, and she has this like smirk and smile about her and this mirth and this understanding and knowing and this empathy until, and I think the moment that got that like broke it for me was when it's Duff is talking to her preacher dad about like his, how he, that fucking absolute killer air horn line, "You've been stooping so low," that fucking exchange breaks Josie. Even she's like,
"You're,
she's
half dropping a man."
It's so incredible and so like a direct confrontation of what the movie is about, right? Not just like, again, you know, the oppression of the white American on the black American in this specific time and place or the preceding 250 years, but specifically like in an era that was supposed to be transitional, that was supposed to lead to a better time, not seeing the effects of that because it was a like the limited practical implications of the movements at play were like, you know, not as far reaching and we're not as like enforced, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like that scene is a direct implication of that. We've seen his other, I'm sort of going off on a small tangent here, but if you'll allow me, we've seen other examples of it where the folks on the, at his other workplaces will rat him out for being sort of uppity, so to speak. Everybody in town calls him boy. It's just like constant aggression after aggression after aggression. And he recognizes in a very direct way, like, Duff, puts in front of the preacher for the first time in the movie from somebody, you know, from another black person, like, "Listen, this is what you are literally subservient. You are, making these, you are perpetuating these conditions that keep your fellow black Americans, down, and you are only doing it to, you know, in the service of a white, essentially like continuing slave driving population." Like he gets as close to radical ideology as this movie gets is in that specific scene, I think. And it's when Josie is unable to take it anymore. She's in the other room weeping, and we see her like emoting strongly for the first time in not just a jovial way, but like in a very real way. It's where you sort of see the extent of the actress's ability as to like draw from different wells of emotion. And it's like, I just think that shift over the course of the movie from this sense of precarity, from the sense of security to precarity and to outright just like collapse. And then strangely, at the very end, a resurgence in the feeling of hope and optimism. But like over the end of the third act, this feeling of collapse, is reflected directly in like the faces and voices and bodies of these characters in a way that I don't know I've seen before. There's a lot to be said for like the filming style there too, but the performances is where I think it really shone for me.
Yeah, I really love the way that you characterize that. And that gets at what I talked about, especially when I call this movie ahead of its time, is just that like, along with the precarity, there's just this like terrible prevailing awareness that all of these characters have of the reality of the situation that they're in. Like, what I love so much about Duff Anderson is he's a character who is almost bemused by the utter crushing absurdity of the world in which he finds himself, right? Like, he is aware of who he is, and he is also aware that nobody will ever see that. He will always only be seen as a black man, a troublemaker, a transient, an outsider, right? And like, you can tell that like, this is the central frustration in his life that is driving him crazy, right? But also like, it's something he's lived with his entire life, and it's something that everybody he knows has lived with their entire lives. And just that fundamental disconnect between the reality of what is, the reality of their interiorities, and the utter denial of that reality of interiority by everyone in the outside world is something that just like all of these characters, you can literally see in their faces how it's affecting them, right? And mm-hmm, it characterizes mm-hmm. all of their relationships with one another. Like, I agree. I think the scenes between Duff and the preacher are some of the best in the movie, probably.
They're
and
like it's the most like, direct, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and there are a lot of direct scenes in this movie too, right? Like, at one point, he literally tries to unionize his job, and all of the black people there are too afraid to lose their job to join up with him.
And one of them fucking rats on him. It's the worst.
It's brutal, man. Yeah. But like, that's the stakes here, right? And like, this is sort of a coming of age story for Duff, where he realizes, like, maybe not for the first time, but he realizes now that like, choosing, and this is the great tragedy of this movie, right, is that like, choosing to have something that anybody should have, that anybody wants, to be a man, to be a family man, to have a life with another person, in this world, it means giving up the pride and the manly sort of like identity that you built for yourself and that you hung on to, right? Like, at the end of this movie, it's a great sort of like coming of age moment, but it's also tragic in the sense that like he capitulates, right? Like he returns to his house, and basically the unspoken thing is like, he's going to go to the cotton field, right? He's going to get a job. He's going to do whatever he has to support his family. And he understands that like that is just exactly what everybody else was doing, right? But like, there's a version of this movie where like, two scenes later, there's a younger black guy that comes to his workplace and tries to unionize it.
Comes off the section gang, and yeah.
And then Duff is the one that turns him in, right? And like, I'm glad we didn't get to see that movie. That sounds more like a Charles Burnett, like Killer of Sheep type of movie.
All that, but, yeah.
But that's the idea, right? Is that there is no way to reconcile as a black person being a person and being somebody who can live in this world. It's just not possible. You have to make yourself small. Otherwise, they're going to take your family from you. Otherwise, you're going to be destroyed in your own identity, right? Like, the irreconcilable nature of what it means to try to be the person you want to be and have to exist in this world is going to rip you to pieces. I think that's what Duff ultimately sees with his dad, right? That's the takeaway that he ultimately has when he sees how his dad was just like him, wanted to be proud, wanted to be more, because of course they did, right? Everybody wants to be more. Everybody's a fucking person. And they couldn't. And the fact that they never got that, it made them so bitter that they ended up turning it on the people who don't deserve it, because mm-hmm. Duff can see that cycle happening again in this movie. And I think that's what gets him to capitulate. But I think just depicting that cycle and depicting the realistic place where it ends necessarily is so powerful, right? And it's something that this movie does so well, because it builds what it builds, what you were talking about, with its performances and with its intersectional examinations of gender and race and class. the way that it can depict what it means, the interiority of a person who is living in this world and all of its implications and all of how it affects the relationships that he's a part of. I just found it spectacular in that way.
Totally spectacular. Pretty devastating. We're gesturing at scenes or even just lines of dialogue that like broke us or like was a verbal literalization of them just like reaching the bottom of the pool, just like scraping the bottom. The line that did that for me was Duff and Josie were having a heightened conversation, and Duff says something to the effect of, "Stop being so damn understanding." It's just like, fuck, man. Like, what?
That's one of my favorite lines in the movie, dude. Brother. It's so good.
Yeah. It's like, what the fuck do you want anymore? It's emblematic of like the knot that he finds himself tied within. He, trying to combat the genuine absurdity of the world and finding that knot just gets like tighter and tighter despite his best efforts. The fact that like his efforts are what are tightening the knot. It's brutal to watch in real time, movie real time. It allows the third act sort of, I guess you could kind of, climax scare quotes, but like his father's passing. I liked that the act of that taking place was not necessarily the knot becoming untangled. Like that doesn't, his father dying does not solve his problems. It's symbolic, if anything. Doesn't have maybe too literal of an impact on his life because he only reunited or like reconvened with his father for the first time in a long time, relatively recently. But it does allow him this moment to like recognize the path that he's taken up to this point. It's like I think he realizes deep down that this, like, I mean, clearly it's not where he intended to end up, with him embarking upon, getting married, looking to build his own future, his own home. His father, his father passing does not solve his problems, but in one fell swoop, he decides, okay, the first sensible choice that I've made that I can make in, many a moon is do the right thing and bring my child back home with me. And like, just as his father passing does not solve his problems, bringing his son back to his home is not going to solve all of his and Josie's problems, but he knows it is the decision that he should make. And in that moment, like it seemed to be enough, drenched in the steep melancholy of the ending of, to your point, Harry, of like, yeah, he's probably going to go into a cotton field because like that's what he has to do to, help build a home for this new family, that he's putting forth, that they're never gonna have the ideal lives they want. They can't have the ideal romance they want. If it were a movie about two white lovers that seen on their first date of them like driving around town and just kind of like looking out at the nighttime, like that would have been the best scene in the movie. It would have been steamy. They would have dropped. Here it's yeah, let's recall some like race driven hate crimes that happened in this town while we're just like driving around looking at all this scenery. That's the romance we have, that those are the lives they have. And there's not a whole lot we can do to remedy that. Unfortunately. So it's, brutal, but a brutalness I liked watching. Would you agree, Jason? Did you like watching that?
I did. It's kind of tough in like a, not to compare it to just, outsider cinema, but like the Wanda of the world, the like Kinuyo Tanaka, some of the harder stuff about one's own world to have realized is what is on display here. So I don't know that like, I love this movie, I had such a good time is really the sentiment you leave with, but it is like a masterwork and arguably, I think, of like its thing. I'm curious because you brought up the, we'll call like his father's death, part of the third act, but like, yeah, functionally the climax. I'm curious about throughout the movie, there's this paralleling thread of Duff and his father, and the way that he sees, the way that Duff sees his life going, could be the way that his father's life went, that, you know, maybe he's not really able to, you know, either overcome or capitulate to the societal expectations of somebody who is trying to settle down, amidst the oppression of white America and amidst the, you know, class divisions and gender divisions that we've already characterized before. And so that is like the path that he sees himself on, at least partially. And he's assailed by, you know, again, the white ne'er-do-wells in town and sort of the, I don't want to even say like conspirators, but the black people in town who seem to go along with it and get along well enough and not really, you know, object or rebel as loudly or proudly as they could. So we have that single-minded idea of Duff throughout the movie until his father passes, when there's a decision, like you said, Cody, there's a decision made that I will be different from my father in some way. I will go get my son, who has been languishing for the last however many years with, you know, in sort of like a not very good part of town. Or, and as he left it with Josie, he said, like, I'll let you know when I get back on my feet, but I'm leaving. I feel like there are two paths that he could have taken there. One is the one that he did take in the course of the movie, and the other is that he could have just struck off on his own, but maybe gone back to the railroad section gang, maybe made something, you know, more of himself personally, but without following that path that he had felt himself pulled to, of settling down, of making a family, of taking a job that pays lower for, you know, more security and stability. And I'm wondering why it was, because maybe I'm just not smart enough or whatever, but what is your opinion, Cody, since you brought up the discussion point, of why the character would have chosen, I'm going to pursue like this thing that was so hard that I already gave up on pursuing just because his father is now passed, that instead of like, I will lean further into the life of my father where I go basically life of a drifter, life of a, you know, potential drunkard. Like, I will not try to settle down. I will not put down roots. I will simply be on the path that I've now set myself on after leaving Josie. Is there a clear like character motivation that you see there that like would put him on one path versus the other? And I can re-explain if this was too
early. No, that makes sense. I like it because I don't think it's a 100% clear, like this, like these two scenes lay out the blueprint for the movie or like Duff's characterization in particular. Like, again, I think it is, my read of it is he's like making the best decision that he can in the moment, based on like knee jerk sort of reactions that like he meets his father, like his primary, reason for going into, he goes to Birmingham, right? That first time to see his kid. And he just by chance, like, because, the nanny, the caretaker who's like watching his son, she's like, oh, like somebody said your dad was around. And I guess I can't remember exactly how long it had been, if it had been said, like, it's been X number of years since Duff saw his father. It seems like it had been a long time. And so like he meets him again for the first time, somewhat by chance, and he sees enough in that conversation, Duff's father, sorry, Will Anderson, he sees enough in Will Anderson. He's tough to be around. He's somewhat standoffish, at least, like, you know, he turns his nose up to Duff being there after a certain amount of time. He basically, you know, he says beat it. He sees enough sort of in the mark, like he's not, like Duff has been presented as something of a personable guy. He has that you know, his scenes with his railway buddies and that one woman, that woman that he has a conversation with earlier in that bar, like he buys her a drink. Like there's like we see enough of the sort of like save the cat moment, Jesus, those sort of like little moments of just like him being a good person, and like those are traits that he does not see in his father. I read it as like he is he sees himself going down this trajectory and he kind of pivots 180 and says, actually, maybe settling down is the best thing that I can do right now. I've met someone, I've met Josie Dawson. She's level headed. Like we are really feeling each other. And him going back the second time, I don't know. It might have been just like the lure of coming back almost as like a barometer at that point, like that weird temptation of like, he probably knows he shouldn't go back because like you said, he vocalized, he wants to set out, he wants to get away from it all. Something indescribable sort of brings him back. Like maybe he wants to see if he, like, how much of him doing this is well justified. He sees a cracked mirror, in his father, and he wants to take one last look in it just to see, like, what sort of perverted Ooh. Image is looking back at him. And like, his father is on the brink of death. The relationship between Will Anderson and Lee is, no different, if not like maybe like a little soured, or a little more soured rather. And again, like the two for two in him, you know, making the choice that, like, and I don't mean to presuppose that this movie is indicative of like a psych. I mean, there's a lot cyclical about maybe not Duff's experience in particular, but just, the way life is for Black people, in this particular area of the country, but also everywhere in the country, as has been said. I don't mean to suggest that there's something like sinisterly cyclical about him, like needing to go back and like look in that mirror again. Like we're shown these two scenes with him and his father for a reason. But yeah, I don't know, no big grand blueprint other than just him like doing, I don't know, making the decision as best he can. And he, I don't know, not necessarily like he's sympathetic to a point. He's not totally redeemable, as we've seen in some like particularly violent scenes that he has. But he's a work in progress. And we're left with sort of an unfinished product, but somebody hopefully on the ascent. Harry, I don't know if you took anything different away from the scenes with his father, but that was sort of my read anyway.
Not necessarily totally different. The thing that stuck out to me so much, and I think the thing that stuck out to Duff, if I may, about that is, Will, his father's relationship with Lee, right? And just the fact that Lee is a character who is very similar in a lot of ways, in parallel ways to Josie, in that she's a very intelligent woman who has been sort of like really kicked around by life and has ended up in this relationship with this guy that can't support her, whom she has to support, doesn't really offer anything, but she doesn't really have any other prospects, and she knows it, and she still has a lot of love and sympathy for him, but he preys on that love and sympathy, right? Like, he pretty actively exploits the fact that Lee still loves him and still cares for him, to do whatever he wants, and in fact blames her and blames her support of him for the reason why he is where he is, largely, right? Like, he's lashing out at everyone, and lashing out at anyone who will let him, but Lee is there to sponge up the most animosity just because she's present, mm-hmm. right? And I mean, I think what you said, Cody, makes a lot of sense, but I think Duff is seeing, like, that's his future if he continues down this path, if he refuses to accept and swallow the bitter pill of what it means to capitulate to society in order to protect his loved ones, right? And those are the stakes of this movie, right? Is like, Duff can either be the man he wants to be, or he can do what's right for his loved ones. And society has created this binary, this and or decision that he has to make. Mm-hmm. And he knows it's not fair. And what I love is the movie depicts not only that it's not fair, but it's like, it's not fair to even us, the viewer, right? Like, we the viewers want to see him succeed. We want to see him rally the Black people in his community. I knew that was never going to happen, right? Because it's not that kind of movie. But like, the heroic arc of this is, and if he was a white character, the arc would be that he can have everything he wants, right? He doesn't have to fundamentally give up his dreams about who he is or who he wants to be in order to protect his loved ones. But instead, we see this great lineage where it's one or the other, right? It's like, if you want your loved ones to be happy, you have to make that sacrifice for them, because mm-hmm. that's the nature of the world that we're living in. And what I really love about that, and what I think makes this movie so fascinating in terms of Black femininity, is that I think he realizes that Josie is also making that sacrifice at the end of this movie, right? Like, that Josie, even more clear-eyed than he was, wanted a relationship with somebody who actually, like, made her feel good, made her feel like a woman, made her feel like someone who could be loved, who wasn't just kind of sad, quote unquote, the way that she said, but with the knowledge that in order to have that relationship, she would have to become that kind of sad person, and so would the person she was with. I think the whole movie is about Duff resisting that because he doesn't want to accept that. And then he sees, you know, like, if I don't accept that, if I don't decide to settle down and take the job I have to take and capitulate to this terrible world that I live in, the people who are going to suffer are going to be Josie and my children. Okay. And I think that, like, that's where we end up. And then, like, you know, I think the movie zooms out, right? And it's like, hey, like, that is the decision that every single person in this movie has had to make, right? Like, all of those guys back at the work, at the factory, all of those guys that are even the guys on the chain gang, right? Like, or the rail gang, like, they made a different choice in that they chose not to settle down for similar reasons. But that's what happens, right? Is that to be nothing but a man, right? Literally, is you have to give up on these things that anybody should be able to have, in order to have that continuity and to survive in this world.
Well, that's what I was hoping that you would like, that you were tying to, is like, he sees the impact of his decision as beyond him. You know, like, I think I was saying that decision is like, well, he could leave or he could stay. And if he stays, then he has to, like, abandon his basic principles of the inherent, like, humanity and dignity of the Black American. And if he leaves, he gets to keep that, but he doesn't get to put down any roots. He doesn't get to, but, like,
framing it, his family suffers,
precisely,
right?
Framing it as like, oh, he's found something worth, for lack of a better term, and this is why it's an ambivalent ending. He's found something worth abandoning that personal pride for, and like racial pride, and like
that
national
is his
pride.
Character arc, exactly.
And yep. That's and I feel like I'm just catching up to where everybody else was, but I like, I appreciate the discussion because it does clarify a few different things to me. Aaron, you seemed pretty cocky about how, like, the end is. It was it an obvious ending to you? Am I just the one catching up to the whole thing? Like, is this,
what do you mean? When did I say anything cocky? What are you talking about?
I really,
you're being a shit heel in the chat, motherfucker.
I'm literally wearing a Knives Out sweater right now. You're talking to us about being cocky.
Chat is not non-textual, I should say.
This is not a Knives Out sweater. This is a cardigan. Excuse me, sir.
It's a pretty good looking cardigan. It's cable knit. And I will say, the Knives Out sweater is cable knit.
It's not even real.
From here it is.
I mean, there's no real cable knit outside of, like, Edinburgh.
We'll see. Now it makes more sense.
There is real cable knit.
You should sit more elevated on webcam.
Listeners at home, cable knit is a real thing that exists. Jason is not correct.
It's visually cable knit. Come on. You can show me a JPEG of a cable knit sweater and say, that's a cable knit sweater. And you'd be like, ceci n'est pas una fucking cable knit sweater? Are you serious?
Sorry, what is your question?
It was about the ending, but it was really just to rib your ass a little bit. Did you have any thoughts on the third act or ending before we start to exhumed?
I mean, I found it to be quite emotionally effective, right? I think it works quite well, right? This character kind of making the decision to kind of do what's best for him and his family, despite the fact that it's you know, kind of arguably the harder path, right? I think that's kind of a powerful statement. I think it works so well because the two leads are so good together, right? They're both just kind of knocking it out of the park, right?
Yeah, we
see them, what it is, I think, is that we see them kind of separately and then we see them together and we see how they react to one another, how they, you know, we talked quite a bit about, you know, Abby Lincoln's kind of reserved smile, right? But I think Duff Anderson has this kind of, you know, kind of coy, humorous way of speaking with her. I think that, like, the fact that we see them, you know, in other circumstances, and then we see them interacting together, and that kind of personal relationship is, like, the main source of joy, right? I think that, like, is really kind of the thing that, like, drives the emotional weight of the ending to me, at least.
Yeah, I think that it just, like, the movie has trained you to understand the full weight of the implication of the choice that he's making, right? Like, in a way that, like, it almost sounds trite to say, but, like, you understand just, like, just how debilitating that is, right? For everybody involved to have to finally sort of, like, and again, it's like, it's a bullet that's been coming for him for the entire movie, right? Which is why he was so afraid to settle down, was why he was so afraid to build a home, why he was so afraid to reunite with his son, because it's like, to choose to have anything in this world is to give up everything, right? To give up who he was, to give up what he wanted. And eventually he had to do that. He had to make that sacrifice for his family. And, you know, like I said, I think that, like, Aaron said, a big reason of the way reason this works so well is because Josie's performance is so good and so nuanced that you understand that that's a parallel journey that she had taken, right? That all the women in this movie also had to make that sacrifice and are still making that sacrifice. And I love that's the parallel, right? That like this movie ends in a place where it's like, hey, like this is what it means to be Black in America. This is what these people had to give up. That's why things, you know, even I would go so far as to say this movie posits a reason why inequality perpetuates itself, right? Because everybody who would fight against inequality also has families. They also have a life that they have to live and people they care about. And therefore they have to make sacrifices. And those sacrifices allow the sort of gears of empire to continue grinding them down and continue an unequal system. And that's just the way it is to be alive, because that's the only choice you have. And who could say if that's the right choice or the wrong choice, right? Yeah. He arrives at this deeply unjudgmental place for the first time, right? Like where he can even say like, I'm the same as my dad, right? Because like I saw my dad struggling to fight against this for his entire life and it didn't work out for him. And I feel that in my bones, but I know that if I want to make anything of my life, I have to give it up. Right. And I think that like, I love that the movie is so sympathetic that we understand that and understand that he's making the right choice for him, but it stings us almost as much as it must have stung him.
It stings us because he, like, through both plot and like scripting and character, like he has seemed so proud of who he is. So like, not like peacocking, but like in that quiet reservation, you know that he's holding on to an intense amount of like personal and like just a sense of self that has been built up over years and years. You know, he's only 27 in the course of this movie textually, which always gets me in older movies when a person looks like 40 years old and they're like 27 years old.
It's interesting, but, right? Because like a pride almost has like a pejorative context, right?
Yeah, yeah.
When somebody's pride. But no, I know exactly what you mean. It's like, it's just a sense of self. It's a sense of like, exactly. I'm not going to let the world tell me who I am. I am a person. I am this person. I am intelligent. I am worthy of love and worthy of a job that treats me properly. I am a human being.
Harry is thinking about the end of Evangelion that just played in theaters recently. I can see it's bleeding into what he's saying right now. He can't even deny it. Look at his fucking face.
It's too dark for you to see my face.
We know what the fuck you're talking about, motherfucker. Don't bring that shit in here.
No, it's I
didn't actually see that in theaters. I wish I had.
Wow. Missed it.
I know, me too.
Fake fan. Fake Anno fan. I've never seen it in any format. Oh, one of these days. I should pirate it, though, as I understand, because I should not check out the Netflix version.
Makes you the last one on the pod to have seen it.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You did last year, didn't you, Cody? Nice.
Better believe it.
Well, I'm glad that we got to like a pretty holistic view of the performances and the way this movie is made and where and its origin as like a story written and directed by a white man. I really love that we've attacked this from all different kinds of angles, and I want to leave the junk drawer open. We have the junk drawer for any final thoughts that didn't quite fit in the larger scope of the movie. Not really one of our typical fare of like, ooh, fun thing I noticed about this one type movies. But if you had anything that didn't fit neatly into a discussion point earlier, now is your time, Cody.
Yeah, two quick visual shout outs. The shot of Duff's railway buddies leaving like the dinner party that they had at their new house, like ordinarily an unnecessary shot to like just get a glimpse of all of them like walking away. One of them was ahead of the pack, and then there were two kind of like walking evenly with one another, and then one bringing up the rear. From what I could, like, there's no audio being captured, so it's not like they're talking to each other like excitedly about anything, but just like the shot of them walking away in the dark, and they're all like dressed in like black suits, and so like just that coupled with the lighting scheme, just like there was something eerie about that. Like, by all counts, Duff will probably see these guys again, but it is like visually, you know, symbolic of him just like truly giving something up and moving on to the next phase of his life, whatever that might mean in that moment. We come to find out what it means, what it might mean later. But I just like that shot, even though it was like kind of sad. And then another shot towards the end, there's a bullet hole in a window of Duff's car that doesn't get remarked upon, but you can see it when he's when he and Josie are on their first date. It's just like kind of you know, in his literal rear view. It's not his rear view like mirror or anything, but it's a window position behind him. Again, I don't think it gets remarked upon, and I can't recall how often, excuse me, we see it throughout the movie, but towards the end when he picks up his son and like gets like started to like to driving back home to Josie, there's like a piece of tape or there's something like shoddily kind of patched over the hole, mm-hmm. Which also doesn't get remarked upon, but it was just a nice sort of visual cue of
also,
like, hey, we're trying to bandage this. Yeah, go ahead.
Is that not the reason why his son gets wet when he's in the car?
That was so. There is a window on the other side where his son was sitting. That's I guess maybe it lines up weirdly. But yeah, like on that side.
Oh, you're
there
right.
Is,
though it did look like a different window.
Yeah. There is. It's. I don't know if it like changes. It does like some magical like changing of places. There's a bullet hole at the start that is like not filled in at all. It's just like left on the vehicle, probably you know, symbolizing something significant. And then at the end, it's just like. It's like putting a band-aid on a big bruise. It's just like kind of cuts through the middle, but there's like still, like there's still a hole in it. He should probably get the glass replaced, but I just, you know, again, an unremarked upon detail that holds like no real weight on, you know, the preceding moments and, you know, like what we can imagine his trajectory will be going forward. But it's a detail that I really appreciated.
Yeah. In that same, maybe even the same shot, a detail I really appreciated too was the same shot, same car. His son is in the passenger seat and it's raining and there's, you know, water dumping in on the kid and he's just scooched as far as he can be toward the window. So he's just getting absolutely drenched. And his father's like, window's broken. You better be come over here if you don't want to get wet. And it's like, it's a small, but like, I read it as a pretty poetic moment of like, oh, it's the journey that, that Duff himself just went through, right? Of like, you can sit there, you can be like obstinate, you can get wet, you can get, like you can face the you know, pummels and punches of the world, or you can come here where there's certain comfort, where there's like, you know, he ended up back with Josie where there was comfort and like it's not going to be easy, but it's going to be worth it because like, you know, now I've dropped this certain, like, for better or for worse, it's only up to the individual to decide, but I've dropped this pretense of, as Harry and I were saying, pride, to like cling to the thing that matters most to me, my wife and my and, you know, the children that I'm preparing to help raise. Or you can sit over there and you can sort of like, not that it's a direct implication or you know, indictment of the decision to pursue, like, you know, individual expression and Black liberation versus, you know, settling down and making a home where you can. But that it is like, oh, that's the same journey he went through. He realized the same thing. Like, he was getting wet. He was finding like no joy, no pleasure in that, and more pleasure, more joy in having, you know, his family and the things that he loved held closest to him. That for me was like a moment that like said as much about the character as it did about like the little joke he was playing on his son, you know?
This isn't really a junk drawer thought, but it does like remind me, I really love the way you characterize that, Jason. And what I love about this movie is that I think a lesser movie would have made his swallowing of his pride either probably more unambiguously good, and they would have made the mistake of sort of portraying what he was doing as maturity that was accounting for a flaw in his person. Rather than a flaw in society, right? And what I love so much about this movie is that we understand that it is a tragic thing for him to give up his sort of like quest to be free, to be a real person, right? And then this movie becomes about something so much bigger, which is basically that, like, in order to be a person who does right by the people around them, who like has loved ones and is willing and able to protect them, you have to accept the inherent unfairness of the world. But the inherent unfairness of the world and his inability to accept it are not a flaw of his. They're just a reality, right? Yeah, and so instead of being this sort of like heroic arc where he overcomes his tragic flaw, which is this unwillingness to accept that he is being treated unfairly, it's a tragedy, right? It's like, in ultimately, like, it's this beautiful, hard won happy ending, because at least we see these two great crazy kids get back together. But instead of being like, oh, thank God, like, he finally came to his senses, it's like, no, he was always, like, of his senses. It's just that, like, he had to make this terrible decision in the end to swallow this pride that he shouldn't have had to make. And I love that the movie holds both of those notions at the same time, right? Like, it makes for such a more nuanced, more full-bodied experience than it might otherwise be.
Yeah.
As for my junk drawer thoughts, speaking of, I love the one little line, just an unbelievably good, poignant, it's expensive to be poor moment, where he talks about how, like, oh, like, the, I think it was, I can't remember, but it was one of the parts in his car is broken. And he mentions, like, well, I don't know if it's worth fixing, but I need that car. And holy hell, as a dude who poured a lot of money into a beater car at multiple different times in his life, is that a relatable thing, right? Like, he's literally like, I need to drive around and, like, fucking go to interviews and stuff in this old beater car. And so, like, I have to keep paying for this car to be repaired, but this car's fucking falling apart, so it's so expensive. And it's like, goddamn, like, that is so,
yeah,
actually, like, just one more good economic material reality portion of this. I don't know. My last junk drawer thought is just that, in addition to everything else, I don't know, like, hopefully we've convinced you to go see this movie, dear listener, but, in addition to everything else, Ivan Dixon and Abby Lincoln have fucking phenomenal on-screen chemistry. And, like, this is legitimately, like, a really beautiful love story, in my opinion. And it's, like, a heartbreaking one, right? Like, at one point he is physically abusive towards her. That's a really hard scene to stomach, but, like, just both of these characters are so lovely and so fully illustrated, and their relationship with one another is so tender and so realistic, because of the precarity and the horrific awareness they have of the world around them, that it really elevates it for me, not only as, like, a race commentary or a class commentary, but, like, I just think this is, like, a fabulous love story in cinema. And I think that shouldn't be overlooked, in addition to everything else that it's doing.
For sure. And that, especially in Abby Lincoln, that, because she is a character who, like, has presumably some degree of self-loathing for being, like, the pretty well-to-do daughter of a black preacher who is directly, like, just serving in many ways the white population.
Yeah, she's fascinating, right? Because it's like, she is educated and understanding enough to know to not have that self-loathing, but she understands on some level that she should, or not that she should, but that other people expect it of her or something, right? So, like, I think it's good that there is no, like, scene like this, but I would, like, you could see a monologue of her, like, telling her husband Duff why she's not ashamed of her job, right? And that would be a scene that would be really powerful, and that would work really well with her character.
It still would, yeah, even though the character is built in a different way, for sure. Aaron, I'll leave the drawer open to you. You look pretty ready for some fun, the next segment of mine that everybody seems to—
I don't think I've ever had a junk drawer throw, brother. I leave it all in the field. All right. I don't hold back.
Got to get it all out.
I hold back.
Get it all out.
He drinks a bunch of drinks and then just sort of zones out.
If I find something to talk about, I will somehow contort whatever point. Harry will be like, I think the person who was nominated, of course, for best supporting actress in this film, I think she did a wonderful job. And I'll be like, did you hear the sound that the song played during that scene? That shit was cool, right? And my smooth transition will make nobody notice a single thing. That's how smooth I am.
They're calling him the greatest podcaster. They're calling him—
I ain't got a single junk drawer in my fucking house.
They're saying that to call him the next Marin is a disparagement to Aaron. Well, thank you so much. I'll close up the junk drawer then. And I will open up this segment nobody seems to like. We've got To All the Loves I've Tried Before. Maybe they like it a little bit more now that we've changed the name. It's the first time that I've come up with it, or that I've introduced it since we actually changed the name formally. Copyright. It's To All the Loves I've Tried Before. We have two episodes. Episode 174 on Ghidorah the Three-Headed Monster from 1964 during the Ishiro Honda's Godzilla series back in 2022. That was a fun time.
Two equally powerful films.
If you want to hear about Godzilla, wait until the end of this episode.
Oy. And episode 86, The Mask of the Red Death, 1964. Go figure. It's another episode that we recorded with our good friend Nick Ransbottom.
Good old Nick.
Who we encourage you again, please, to donate and share to his GoFundMe for funding some pretty life-saving critical CF care. Those you'll find the link in the show notes. I will tweet it again. But what are the chances? Nick's getting pretty lucky on this podcast. A few episodes in a row where we've had the same year of a movie that we've discussed with our good friend Nick. But that's it so far. So let's bump up those numbers. 1964, make some better movies from 1964. Hey, Hollywood, listen to me. Make some good movies from 1964 that the Trilemma wants to play.
Special shout outs, by the way, to that one. I think Mask of the Red Death wasn't, but one of the previous episodes that Nick was on was the only time we've ever recorded three episodes in a row, which we did when he was in town and in person. And that was a challenging
wasn't
day
that wild?
For everyone involved. Poor Nick looked like he was about to faint at the end of it, but he was a real trooper.
I want to say that Pokemon Detective Pikachu was one of those. If I remember correctly, that
I think so.
Run,
yeah,
because I remember I wasn't able to join for brute force.
I think, man, that was the third we did, right?
Yeah, it must have been the last of three. And that's back when we were in person up in that office. So I left you guys alone in my office. Wow. Jeez,
no, I think you were just literally at your desk. You were like still in the office.
I had to do work or something. That's right. God, what a long and storied career we have with Nick Ransbottom. Check out his GoFundMe in the show notes and on Twitter, where we'll be posting all of this stuff that you've heard us talking about. But we have one actual final segment of the show that we should introduce. Me and Harry do it together whenever we're both here.
Yes, thank you, Jason. It is the segment we like to call
Cody's Noties.
Jason, do you remember what I said to you two recordings ago? I mean, I'm just going to go ahead and answer because you obviously don't. Because
that wasn't much time.
What I did say was, if you poo-poo the previous segment one more time, I was going to withhold the noties. And much like the Joker, I'm a man of my word. I compiled noties for this episode.
Don't do this.
Don't worry.
We still got
something, I think fun for most of us. I compiled noties for this episode. I'm going to cast them away. They're never going to see the light of day. You're never going to know what the fuck
I'm
we were
going
to talk
Harry.
About.
Joker's trick.
Hey, no need to apologize to Harry and Aaron, because they will still get to participate in an alternate segment that I like to call, when was this photo of Jason Daphnis taken? Or I guess more appropriately,
wait.
When was this photo of Jason Daphnis posted on Facebook? So what I'm going to do link here in the chat. Aaron and Harry, you're going to take turns guessing when
you're
this
doing
picture
the,
of Jason.
John Barenthal thing? Wait.
Aaron and Harry will have the opportunity.
All these
to
are
guess
just pictures of his penis. I don't understand.
At 6:54 p.m.
shortly. You're gonna whoever gets closest will get a point. I've got three photos. For today's purposes. More on standby if this segment is needed at a later date. It's kind of like a spare tire in the car. Like, it still kind of technically gets us to the end of the road, the end of the episode, but. You know, probably a suboptimal course of action. Jason can try to sabotage your guesses if he really wants to. He also can flat out cut this segment if he really wants to, but he knows
not a chance
that,
now.
That will just further dead air in an episode. It's going to be worse for the effort. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to put this first photo Google link in the chat here. Go ahead and open that up. Aaron and Harry, feel free to click that link, mull it over.
I was there, I think.
This is this is me, just for the listeners, this is me in a sampan. I'm pulling my eyelids out as far as I can. I'm being the most racist you can possibly imagine me being.
Jesus. I thank you for the reminder, Jason. I forgot to note, when this episode airs, I'll do a scrub through the episode to make sure this segment is actually intact within the course of this episode's runtime. I will tweet the photos out from my personal account. I'll quote retweet the episode tweet from the trial of account. That way, you know, you're going to know the years because I'm going to say them on the episode, dear listener, but you can at least like match them up to the best.
And
you
got a dead man switch for the whole Google Doc is opened and exploded.
Yeah,
to
I've
the
got
world.
I got C4 taped to my chest for the indefinite future. we'll see what happens. Aaron claims he was here, so I'll go to him first. Aaron, when do you think this photo was? The year. When do you believe this image was, we'll say, posted to Facebook?
I think the answer to that is 2019.
All right, Aaron says 2019. Harry, what's your guess?
Man, I was going to go 2018, I guess.
You want to still go 2018?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay. I'm good. The actual retail price of the year this photo was put on Facebook is 2019. It's a very close contested effort, but Aaron was dead on, so he gets the point.
It was.
Is that from a Halloween party?
Yeah. Do you have the story behind this, or should we sort of reminisce?
I mean, I didn't expect this much participation from you. I don't know the exact story, but
I think I know the story. I think so. This was a Halloween party. I know that it was 2019 because it was when Aaron and I moved in together and before COVID.
That's how you
would have placed it. I moved in with him in like August, September 2019.
Wait, is that your old apartment?
This is not my old apartment. This is, I think.
No.
Their names?
Where are you?
Katie and Dave Clapp. Extended friends of the Game Informer folk. So there were two parties that night. I believe the second one, Aaron was going to leave. We ended up leaving this one somewhat early because there was like Kyle's or something that was going on that same night. But Aaron did Bob from Bob's Burgers, I think. Remember, you didn't really have a mustache at that point, so you bought a fake mustache.
The joke is that I had not seen Bob's Burgers.
Yeah. It was a real joke. It got everybody. But I was, as you can see from this picture, I am wearing a shirt, a replica of the shirt that Justice Harrison, is it? I forget the actor's name, wears in Detective Pikachu as the main character. And that's
Justice Smith.
Thank you. I think I'm thinking of Justice Harrison.
Abe was Pikachu. Yes, that's a
Pokeball.
Good
he was wearing a Pokeball outfit, and that is Kelsey Spaulding behind me wearing the headcrab costume. Always did one above everybody else for these costumes. So, wow, what a trip down memory lane. I don't need to do this for everyone, Cody, but I felt like since it was shared with me, it was worth it.
Hey, yeah, whatever you like. We've got two more here. I'll throw the second one in the chat.
Oh shit, we've got more.
Yeah, I got three. Every good trilogy comes in threes.
Aw, this is adorable.
I'll toss it to Harry first this time. What year was this photo posted to Facebook?
That'd be 2014, I believe.
2014, locking you in for that. Aaron.
October 2014, right? Is that right? We'll see.
Do I know any of the other people in this photo? I don't, right?
I can't answer that question for you.
Okay. Oh, okay. So so the viewers know this is a picture of him, I guess, outside of the Game Informer offices in Minneapolis. Yes.
The former Game Informer in Minneapolis.
Former Game Informer offices in Minneapolis, with two other people, one of whom is smiling normally, one of whom is kind of soy facing, to be quite honest. Jason is doing about a half soy face himself. He's got he's looking interesting, actually. I mean, they would have been an intern in college. I mean, yeah, 20. In order to be nice to Harry, you guessed one number. I'll say 2015, even though that's probably incorrect. It's 2015.
Oh, I'm worried that maybe they didn't post it till 2015. So that's entirely possible.
Valid fears did. Because it is 2015. That was the year. Hey, we got one more. The contest
was taken in 2014, though.
Maybe it was like a throwback. Like, I remember my time. You know, that kind of bullshit. Like, you know, who knows?
This is the photo I'm going to pick up. Because this year, 2014, marks 10 years since I first set foot in Minneapolis as part of the Game Informer internship.
That's right.
I honestly don't remember if this was. This must have been partway into the internship because I arrived barefaced and I decided to try the mustache thing during it, and it never really took off. As you can see, this is about as rich as it got.
Well, I don't. Hey, remains to be seen because we do have one more photo here. The contest is technically all but decided. There's still pride on the line, going for the shutout versus, you know, a 2-1 victory. But I'll go ahead and throw the last photo here in the chat. Same question. When was this photo posted on Facebook? We'll go back to Aaron is shaking his head in a good fashion. We'll throw it to Aaron first. Aaron, give us a year here.
So what I'm looking at here is somebody who I don't know if I'd be able to identify was Jason. Kind of a close-up shot. He's wearing much less hip-looking glasses, I'll say, kind of rectangle frames.
Oh my God, he's got a
his
gun.
His facial hair is looking much worse and much less kempt. He's got the long, so I'm going to say, he's got the long high school hair, you know, that every boy in high school has, where it's like, you're definitely not cutting your hair as much as you should in order to look good. But like you don't
I had
know
that same
yet.
Hair once upon a time.
Yes, yeah. I had exactly that hair for many years. I'm going to say this is 25. I'm going to say this is 2011.
All right, Aaron is going with 2011 is Aaron's guess. But what is Harry's guess?
Fuck, 2011 was going to be my guess. That looks like 2011 facial hair to me. Like you just are starting to be able to grow facial hair, but you're not quite there yet. I'm going to go with 2012.
2012. The Mayan prophecy.
Which, for the record, that's because this is exactly what I looked like in 2011, like to a T. Same facial hair, same hair, the whole kit and caboodle.
The whole kit and caboodle. This is actually a 2010 photo, so nobody got it dead on. But Aaron was closest by year.
Okay. I'm impressed with that much facial hair in 2010. I don't think I had facial hair in 2010.
I had a mustache by the time I was 13. Not a good mustache, but listen, all that is to say, much like oh boy, this is going to be dumb. You know, and we watched Duff Anderson exhibit elements of self-sabotage throughout the course of the movie that we talked about today. That does not need to permeate real life. We don't need to sabotage our bits. Our bits are so good. We got good bits, gentlemen. But I'm happy to bust this out whenever we need it. Aaron was the winner here, cruising to a 3-0 victory. This has been, when was this photo of Jason Daphnis taken? The game that is the sensation that is sweeping the nation.
It's sweeping the nation. You should know, listener, that when was this photo of Jason Daphnis taken in lieu of Cody's Noties followed the award winning, much lauded, always beloved, to all the loves we've tried before, and I will never, ever again intimate that it was anything less than the people's choice and the voter's choice. It was both electoral and popular vote, the favorite segment Trila has ever done, called
wow, both.
To All the Loves We've Tried Before. Cody, well, thanks for that, I guess. Hey, listener, you can find links to
we
all
love
of
you,
those
big
things, including the pictures that Cody has referenced here. Hey, Cody, could you send those to me? Because there's this cool thing I can do with the app I use. I can put in photos into the chapter headings on the podcast. So that if you're listening to the podcast, you can see the images when they get to that chapter. You know what? Why not? Check out your podcast feed if you get here and you'll see one or two of those pictures. But thank you, Cody, for ending our episodes as always on a more fun note than they started on. Hard to do with a movie like this. You know, we were all chipper in spirit after watching Nothing But a Man, which you can catch. I think it's on the Criterion channel. It's at least got a Criterion disc. I watched it on Amazon, I believe.
I think that's the only place. I don't think they've brought it onto the channel. It does have a Criterion release. I think it is just, I said streaming earlier, but it is just rentable from what I can recall. Hopefully the fact that it got a Criterion release back in February means that it'll be streaming sometime in the near future.
Yeah, fingers crossed. I also watched it on Amazon because despite having bought the Criterion collection and despite said collection being in my mailbox right now, I lost my fob into my apartment, so I can't get into my mailbox right now. So until I get another fob as soon as possible, I won't have access to said Blu-ray. So I had to pay the Bezos man.
Oh,
just a little fun update as to the state of my life right now.
Nothing but a fob. Well, y'all can check it out in a lot of different places. Hey, my little hack, go to archive.org, videos, all video, and then just use like the Boolean search quotation marks, the movie you're looking for in the year. Six times out of ten, you'll find it there. That's how I found all the Kinuyo Tanaka movies that we saw for gifts and stuff at the trial. And hey, check out archive.org. It's literally the last good place on the internet. And you can find more episodes of Try Love wherever you get podcasts. Search for a movie that you've seen before. We've covered almost 300 of them at this point. Coming up this year, we will mark our 300th episode in, I think, October, late September is the projected time frame if we don't have any extras or delays. So keep an eye out for that. We'll have at least some fun stuff planned. And until then, you can find the Trilon at trilon.org. I should mention, I got time, just enough time to finish reading a piece by a former guest from the episode on Electra, My Love, Nisi Agazawane, I believe once Trilon volunteer, now doing stuff with MSP Film. Check out their piece.
Cool dude.
Yeah, check out his piece for Perisphere. It's called Back to the Future, Michael Romer's Nothing But a Man, about how a lot of this film in its making and its tone and its setting and its sort of implications are way ahead of its time, as you'll hear frequently. But this is pretty well put by Nazi. So check it out at Perisphere, also in the show notes. Didn't mention that up to now. So there's your CTA, Nazi. Thank you so much for being on the podcast again and for contributing to Perisphere. And I don't know, I don't need to thank the listener. You've been here for too long anyway. So just check us out on Twitter at Trilove Podcast. Find the Trilon at Trilon Cinema. Find the Jason at Nintendoofus.
On the note of Kinio Tanaka, I believe her films are, like, virtually all of them are streaming on the Criterion channel. Of course, wow. You know, do whatever you got to do to you know, that archive black web stuff that I certainly know nothing about. Come on. But if you have access to the Criterion channel and want to you know, help their metrics and that stuff, they're all bangers. So watch them.
The Gene Siskel Film Center is running a series on her films.
Oh, really?
And directing.
When?
Coming up. Something to think about. I don't know off the top of my head, probably a month or two, probably April if I had to guess.
Damn. Check them out. Nice. Chicago.
Yeah. I know typically folks don't really find a reason to head to Chicago, but there's a good reason right there. I've been Cody Narveson. You can find me on Blue Sky at Cody Narveson and Twitter at Cody_BH.
Yeah, you're going to talk about the Godzilla stuff, right, Aaron? So I don't have to talk about it right now, but that stuff's coming up. There's going to be a, like, I think it's at Music Box, right? Or where is it?
Are you done with your... Excuse me, sir? Are you...
I'm sorry.
Excuse me, sir. Are you... I don't know what this is, but are you finished?
Okay, you're the right Chicago now? Guy. I think I'm the Godzilla guy, pretty obviously. I think we have dual ownership of this particular event. But anyway, I'll just say, Jason saying CTA, the marketing term, activated my fight or flight. So my hackles are up. You can find me when my hackles have gone back down on Twitter at PunishTake. Just kidding. That's my secret, Captain. My hackles are always up. You'll see it on Twitter or elsewhere. Farewell.
Folks, you can find me at the Music Box on June 8th, 2024, where they are doing the 24-hour Showa-era marathon of the Godzilla films. I have tickets. I will be going. I will be seeing at least a lot of them. A lot of people, ever since I posted this to my Instagram story and to Twitter, have reached out to me saying that I am, what they say, the biggest Godzilla fan that they're, you know, that they are aware of, that they know. That's what they're saying, folks. So you can catch me at the Music Box here in Chicago. Thank you. Peace out.
It ain't gonna be easy, baby, but it's gonna be all right.
Heat wave.